Around the world, people are working to bring a greater sense of balance to the planet. Earth Wisdom Circles is here to showcase these people and projects. Now, here's your host for Earth Wisdom Circles on Empower Radio, Elaine Grohman.
This is Elaine Grohman on Earth Wisdom Circles on Empower Radio. Today is the winter solstice, so it's a very powerful day, and it's a very important conversation I'm having with my return guest today, Jem Muldoon. Jem is an advanced trauma certified practitioner and trainer, a certified restorative practitioner and trainer, a career public educator, and a lifelong learner and a spiritual seeker. I've had the pleasure of knowing Jem, going on 20 years, I think now, and the work that she has done, the heart that is who she is so greatly needed right now. So welcome back to the show, Jem.
I'm so thrilled to be here with you today, Elaine.
So, Jem, we want to talk today about what are we going to do to restore and to learn how to thrive as communities in this post-COVID, or when post-COVID is done, but certainly in this hugely global turmoil that we've had and experienced with not only our health, but our communities, our ability to get together with families, to have, you know, so many of the important social structures have been put on hold or entirely stopped. So as an advanced trauma practitioner, and certainly as a restorative practitioner, you have a wealth of information. So let's just begin and help me understand, or help the listening audience understand a little bit about your background and how you got into this.
So I actually started as an English teacher, and I was an English teacher for about 11 years. And during that time, I felt that what was happening in the classroom was lost on those that were making decisions inside the classroom. So I left, and I have a PhD in educational policy from the University of Michigan. And while I was there, I realized that a college and university setting was not going to give me the relevance that I needed. I felt like there were some significant changes that had to happen. And I think I was at the point in my life where I understood that it had to happen at the grassroots level. So I went back into practice. And at first I was an assessment consultant for a countywide educational service agency. And in those 10 years, I watched how public education has changed from being a place where we were drawing out the unique brilliance of students, instead became completely focused on grades and test scores, and really no meaning, no relevance, no relationships. And so we had opened up an alternative high school at that time, and I was trying to spend as much time as I could, because those young people reminded me about what I had to offer and the contribution that I could make. And someone asked at that point, have you ever thought about, we'd really like someone to take over the bullying prevention work. And I said, I love that, and it's a little bit more than that. And so during the last 10 years of doing this work, I'm a safety and well-being consultant, and that's how I got into, as I learned more about bullying prevention, I started understanding that the roots of bullying is really this idea of othering, that we have divided ourselves so much, and that the power that we acknowledge and celebrate here is about material things and about external things, and that the power, we don't understand the internal power. And as I started learning more about bullying prevention and the types of young people and adults who engage in that, what I realized is that the roots of this often is people who have been, who have experienced damage done to them by others, and especially in childhood. And so then I started learning about adverse childhood experiences, and I started getting deeper and deeper into the trauma work. And as I got into the trauma work, I realized that if we can't stay down there, because that is our fact and reality. But once you have that knowledge, I really believe that it's a responsibility that you have to rise up and do something about it to prevent that. And then this idea of healing only happens understanding what the roots are, but then it is your responsibility as the person who has that knowledge to bring that healing. And that's when I started understanding restorative practices. And as I got deeper into restorative practices, I understood that this is not, I knew that intellectually, but at a spiritual level, I started understanding that restorative practices is really a return to humanity. It is really a return to who we are. And then I started following some really incredible people in the trauma age, but I was listening to them and they were shifting. Like I was shifting, but I feel like the people who have done the intense trauma work are now a part of what they're calling collective healing. And I am watching people who have done academic work that are talking about the spirituality and about spiritual, that when we understand trauma, not only does it give us the responsibility to prevent that from happening, but we have at our fingertips now a return to a spirituality that has been lost in all of this over the last 500 years at least. Well, in this particular country, the last few hundred for sure. Like I'm not sure it existed once there was the dominator cultures that came. And we kind of over time we lost the beauty of humanity. I know that's a really long story, but this is truly, I did not understand that getting into bullying prevention work was really a spiritual journey for me.
Absolutely. And thank you for that. Not too lengthy. I think it was beautiful because it's. I think we have to understand that we're in this very powerful time of change. And what does that mean? And, to change means that you have to consciously and honestly look at what is not working. But we have been so accustomed, and I know that you have seen this and I have seen this many times, is to point our finger at, as you say, the other, and say it's your fault or it's this system's fault. And the reality is we are all culpable. We are all have knowingly or unknowingly have been steered in the direction of belief systems and opinions that have no basis in fact, that have no commonality of community as human beings. And I think that it's really brilliant that you're so knowledgeable, but so have the capacity to bring about this very important truth that we are spirit. So to finally acknowledge that is fundamental to anything that we hope to change. Because we are spirit in a body. We are not suddenly becoming spiritual.
Right.
We are it. So
right.
What have you found, Jem, as the single most important thing that you have been seeing repeatedly that people are beginning to acknowledge?
One thing is that the priorities that we have. So in the trauma work, we understand, and this is, I'm going to just give you a super simplistic idea of the development of the brain and then what happens in trauma. And I'll be brief, but I think it's important for us just to have, for people who don't know, just to give them a brief outline. So our brain develops from the very back of our brain where there's the brain stem. They're basically, let's divide the brain into three parts. It's far too simplistic, but just for the sake of this. So in that first part is where our senses live, and it's where our deep memories live. And that's also where we experience trauma. This part of the brain is our survival brain. It's also called the reptilian brain. And in this brain, there is one question that is constantly asked. Am I safe? Am I safe? Am I safe? This safety is not about cameras or metal detectors. This is that sense of safety. So it could be the psychological safety to speak up. It could be relational safety in order to trust. Once the brain feels that it's safe, then it moves to the second part of the brain, which is also the second part of the brain to be developed, and that's the limbic system. This is the heart of humanity. This is the heart of being a mammal. This part of the brain constantly asks the question, okay, if I'm safe, am I loved? Do I belong? And this is where our feelings and emotions come. If we feel safe and if we feel that we belong, now this third part, which is the last part of our brain to develop, it was the last part in the species to develop. And in childhood, this is usually by the time we're about 25 is where the executive functioning part of our brain has really done its most optimal growing. This part of the brain says, okay, then what can I learn from this? So we are constantly needing to feel safe, to feel connected. And when we are those two things, we can feel present. Only when that happens can we activate this part of our brain. So here we've got the mammalian part of us that still relies on that protection and safety, safety, belonging. Here's where we say, what can I learn from this? But this part of our brain is not just about reasoning. It is about cooperation, collaboration. It is putting belongingness into action. We cannot function as a community if we are not accessing the reasoning part of our brain, the problem-solving part of our brain. And so what I think that has happened over time, and especially COVID has not just exacerbated it, but truly exposed it, is that I think as a society, we have become very comfortable, not even knowing we're living in these parts of our brain, in the part that doesn't feel safe, in the part that doesn't belong. And we're trying to access this part of our brain sounding so intellectual, when the bottom line is, as a society, we're functioning as if we are individuals, we are isolated. And so because of that, our actions, our policies, our programs do not serve the entire community. They don't for sure focus on our children, which should be the meaning of our lives. It doesn't focus on our elderly, who are the second most or equally important part of our lives of humanity. And because we're living back here and not truly accessing here, everything that we're doing is falling short of the ultimate things that we could be doing for one another, for ourselves, in order to serve one another.
You know, that is so important, because I think that immediately, as you were talking about this reptilian part of our brain, are we safe? We forget also that we are chemical beings. So every thought creates a chemical reaction that can then supersede or override everything else. Become at reactionary rather than capable of responding. And that, I think, is the big challenge that we have. And we have associated, and we've been trained to associate our reactions with our belief systems. And our belief systems, in particular religion, in particular ideologies, that say we must believe to belong. And even if the belief has nothing to do with truth or workability.
Oh, it's so true. So, and the way that we have moved into some of these belief systems, it is truly back here. Because if you think about, like, certain religions will say, you must in order to, and no matter what you do, it's never going to be enough. Now, how in the world is the individual brain supposed to believe that they are safe? Because this idea of the system being in threat is exactly what you said. It's chemical. So it could be that you don't have enough food. It could be that you don't have proper shelter. It could be that you're in relationships that are insecure. The brain doesn't know what that threat is. It just knows that it's under threat because it lives in a place where there are no words and no feelings. So our belief systems are really, we think that because we believe something that it's solid. But what I've learned about the brain is that the brain perceives threat. It perceives anything new as a threat. So sometimes new learning, the brain will say, we're shutting that thing down because that seems to fly in the face of what I believe. And so what we think we are standing on, it is not rock solid. It is a perception. And so actually, One of the things that we have lost is the ability to really celebrate and to acknowledge and recognize when we're in cognitive dissonance. This is something that I've been teaching over the last few months because I feel that it starts to get at what you were talking about. So here's an example. My values and beliefs, they just didn't come because I'm this individual person. It could be my DNA. It could be the epigenetics that sits on top of my DNA. It could be the experiences that I've gone through. But my brain doesn't care because my brain thinks that whatever I feel is because it's the absolute truth. Cognitive dissonance is where we have this value and belief, and then we behave in a way that doesn't really jive with that. And what happens when we do that? So here's a couple of examples. My doctor has told me that I must quit smoking immediately because I have a terrible health issue. And on the way home from the doctor's office, I start to rationalize that because I don't want to behave in that way. So I say to myself in this cognitive dissonance, you know what, that doctor, he probably doesn't know what he's talking about. And I go ahead and buy the cigarettes and I start smoking on the way home. And I rationalize and justify by saying, I'll think about that tomorrow. Or a person who is a pacifist and a patriot is drafted into war. And then they have to do this rationalization and justification. When we are in a place where we're being asked, where our beliefs and values are being challenged, our brain believes that it's a threat to our system. So because of that, when we are confronted with things that might cause us to challenge our own beliefs, it could confirm them and totally validate them. But as we are right now as a people, we are so averse to feeling that discomfort that we just dismiss it. And so when we dismiss it, what we're watching are people who see a new policy and immediately say it's socialist or whatever it is that they want to say, because inside they don't want that discomfort. And that discomfort is actually the birthplace of new ideas and innovation and creativity. Yeah. And so part of the reason that we are having such a hard time is that we don't like ambivalence. We don't like uncertainty. But the ironic thing is, we are living in uncertain times, and the time that we need right now is to embrace that uncertainty and to do this together.
Yes, and I think that, thank you for that, Jem, because, and again, my guest is Jem Muldoon, and we're having a conversation about growing community in a post-COVID world, and as a restorative practitioner and trainer, the work that she does and has done her entire career is to build this infrastructure within the human mind of we are always in the midst of change. By definition of being a living being, we are constantly changing. We are not the same individuals we were last year or 6 months ago or 10 years ago. By definition, if we're alive, we are growing and changing. And I think that And tell me what you think about this idea, is that I think that because we're in this rapid time of the dissolution or the dissolving of systems that have falsely held themselves above others, people don't know how to think. And they are terrified with not knowing. And the reality is, we really don't know much of anything. We just assume we do. And when we're willing to say, gee, this isn't working, and we're feeling that, as you say, cognitive dissonance, then that feeling should tell us on its own, something isn't working. That's the signal.
Right.
Something isn't right here, or you would not feel this disturbance.
And to say, wow, this is interesting. Now I wonder where this is coming from. It could just be our brain that's feeling something new, but let's just stop for a minute. Let's pause. Like I'm all about right now returning the pause button, because that pause is a really beautiful place. It could be something that's not worthy of our time. really, you know, we give it the attention that it deserves. But then it could be something that is really important for us to pay attention to, but we don't like that. And because of that, we see engaging in rational discourse, like the exploration of ideas, we have gotten so into ourselves that we think that our values and beliefs are the things that define us. We think that our actions are the things that define us. We think that what happens to us are the things that define us. How we are defined is so much deeper than that. It goes all the way down to the heart of humanity. And it is, I feel like people are living up here at this shallow world and wondering why in the world they're grasping for something more, why in the world they're hungry and they're thirsty for something so much deeper. And yet we don't have places that feel safe enough. We don't have places that say, you belong to us. Even if we don't see we don't ever see the light of day together, you and I are, we belong to each other and we're going to live. We're going to coexist here. People don't understand that without that safety and belonging, like truly without that feeling of safety and belonging, we can't engage in the kind of learning and speaking and thinking and all of the things that are needed in order for us to really start making moves forward.
Well, and you know, today is a very important day for people to recognize that this winter solstice, in terms of the Indigenous world, this is called the time of the Black Lodge. And what that means is the time for going within, the time of hibernation, the time to be quiet and to look and assess and really bring meaning into your life. What is meaningful to you? Not just what are you willing to kill and die for, which is what religion wants, which is what belief systems want, is how do we collaborate with life? Because we are evidence of life. But at the moment, we are also evidence of our capacity because of our choice to also destroy. And that is something we really need to look at and think about in very different ways. So how do you think COVID has kind of pushed us into this great awakening, if you could call it that, or this opportunity to awaken that more cognitive part of our brain that is imaginative and illuminative and has these possibilities for new and better ideas?
You know, what I know best is schools, and we've not done this correctly. And there are a lot of places that you can't really say that out loud because it's seen as a blasphemy and heresy. Like, how could you say that? Well, we were headed in a wrong direction before COVID, and I was hoping that the shutdown would actually give us an opportunity to rethink some things. What happened is, as soon as we could, people wanted to go back to a normal. That normal wasn't working before and it doesn't exist anymore. We haven't even truly understood how we've changed through this, and all of us have definitely changed. We just don't know exactly what that looks like yet. So my dog is my dog.
It's okay. Don't worry about it.
All right. So there was an opportunity. So basically here's an example. Our kindergartners, the most important thing that happens in school is for them to really understand the sense of community, who they are within their little classroom. And that is, it seems like such a simple thing, but it's powerful. It is truly the most important thing that we do in kindergarten. Many of our second graders now really didn't have a kindergarten year. They had a little bit, and then there was complete shutdown. We have second graders who have not understood the sense of community. They have not grown socially and emotionally with their peers to get to second grade. And so we might have, they talked about learning loss. From the very beginning, we should have been more concerned about social emotional growth and development. So right now, there was an opportunity for us in the fall of 2021 to say, you know what? Our kids have missed out on being together. Let's take 6 weeks. And the only thing that we're going to do is to have everybody understand this is what school is. This is who we are when we're together. The whole thing to be based on social emotional learning. At the same time, we have a movement, even in Michigan right now, where the legislators are looking at the term social emotional learning as being what they're calling now Marxist philosophy that is taking away the rigor of the schools. And we have movement inside our legislature right now that's trying to take away Public Acts 360 to 366, which is restorative practices. We have a state rule on restorative practices being used in schools in Michigan, and also to stop the SEL being taught in schools. And so the opportunity that we had actually to use social emotional learning, restorative practices, trauma-informed practices, cultural proficiency, all of these beautiful things that build communities, that build social emotional skills and strategies with our kids. We have a growing number of people in our nation and in the state that are saying, we've got to get back to basics. And these are people that don't understand, without that sense of safety, without that sense of belonging, this part of the brain, the executive functioning part of our brain, can never develop optimally and can never be used fully. So people think that we have to get back here. We have to take a pause and we have to start back here first. And that is the huge gap between what is really needed. And this is in my humble opinion, but I'm really thrilled to tell you that I am just an apprentice in this understanding. And people who say that this, that the way we were, that is the only way, and that is a way for us never to be together, never to understand the power of what it is, what it feels like when a community is whole.
Well, you know, I think that that is so important, because we have to look, you know, strategically and in what's called a spherical way in a medicine understanding, is that we, as when we're children and we have an understanding that if you have siblings, that you're a part of a group of siblings and you're a part of a group of a family unit. And then you're a part of a group of an extended family unit and therefore friends. And as we're growing and changing, which is an inevitability, then we begin to broaden our scope of, well, what does it mean, as you say, to be a part of a community? How do we engage in contributing, whether we're a part of a group or a club, or we want to be engaged in some kind of study, and then later in the work world? But it all begins, as you said, is, do you feel safe? Are you heard? And we see so often that the consequence of older generations never having received this guidance, that they are raising children to be fearful people.
Yes.
And so they don't understand that there is a great difference between normal and common.
Yes, very nice. Yes.
Because normal is workable. Normal is reliable. But common is what we think of as normal, and it is not the same at all.
Right. I'm glad that you talked about the spherical thing, because one thing that I have seen is that the deeper that people get into the trauma work and restorative work, the deeper that they are relying on Indigenous philosophies. So there's one model that I teach, which is, it's called the Circle of Courage, and it is about the four universal needs. So instead of looking at competition and achievement and of the things that we look for, individual growth, what this is, they have it inside a medicine wheel, with true north being generosity, which is the ultimate thing, that you are here to serve others, and not being the best in the world, but being the best for the world. But the thing that you start with in the circle of courage is a sense of belonging. And it is something that is the most important thing in child raising in Indigenous cultures, because without that sense of community, then a person does not, is first of all, doesn't feel the confidence to be able to take risks. And learning is about taking risks. So it's not about doing things that are harmful. It is about doing something simple, something new. So that sense of belonging from the very beginning, there is a respect for elders that is really taught to children, so that it doesn't matter what adult is speaking to children. The children trust that the adult has their best interest at heart. Compare that to this way that we are raising our children now, where if somebody else talks to you, another adult talks to you, that's none of their business. We're not living by this taking a village. That I know that in some churches that they have when children are confirmed by the congregation symbolically says, we will take part in raising this child. That is truly about the only place that I can think of that we do that. We try to do this in schools, but then we have such a disconnect between our school families and the educators that this idea of this common, this normal, how we've defined it is still so isolated that none of us can truly get to where we want to be. None of us can truly bring out that brilliance in our children because we're not working in common. We're not working together.
Well, you know, it's interesting because you are speaking about this medicine wheel and courage being at the top, but I'd like to give you a different perspective about that. There is an ancient wheel called the perspective wheel. And in every medicine wheel, the north is also the place of knowledge and wisdom. Courage is not there. And the reason it is not there is because you have to have the strength of the south, which is where the emotions reside, and to be able to have the trust. Trust is what is the ennobling of what we refer to as courage. But the word courage is really misunderstood because it is seen as someone who is willing to go to battle it with weaponry is seen as a courageous person. And really, it is how do you bring knowledge in to blossom into wisdom? You have to have trust in what it is you're doing. You have to know that it is workable. So in the perspective wheel, you're no matter who we are and however long we've lived, we are always standing in the middle of that circle.
Right.
But what is important to understand is, from what perspective are you reacting? Are you reacting from the perspective of a 5-year-old child? Are you having the perspective of an adult who is the parent of a child? From what perspective are you seeing this situation? So that you can always come back to the center.
Right. Yeah.
It's very, very important.
Yes.
And courage is, you know, courage is often associated with bravery, which is often associated with unnecessary risks. So our words are very, very complicated because our words have been so intentionally misdirecting.
Yes.
And that's a big problem.
Yes.
Very big problem. So what do you see, Jem, as you are talking with people that are now coming to you and say, what do we do differently here? You know, how, as you said, people are beginning to understand that there is a spiritual part that we have to look at the commonality of our existence, that we are not smart enough to create anything in this world. We think we've made things, but we really only used raw materials that have already been here in place for us. We're manipulating what is already present.
Right.
We're not creating anything new. But we have to decide, are we creating something that will grow, that will nurture, that will give us measure, that will help us move forward collectively?
Well, I think that I really do believe that these four universal values, belonging, mastery, independence, and generosity, I do believe that that is a way for us to really refocus. A lot of people aren't interested in that. And so what I have, what I've been trying to do, and I'm involved in a couple of other projects that's really trying to get people to come together to talk about things. This is, and that has been a challenge in itself. So we've got people who don't, they don't understand the importance of us being able to explore ideas. When we explore ideas together, we are actually acknowledging that we are part of something bigger than ourselves. To create space where people can feel that sense of safety and belonging so that they can engage in new learning and with one another. We've working for the last 5 or 6 years with Wayne State University in trying to bring community dialogues into places, and have really done some really great work where we've explored, for example, our first one was exploring the Second Amendment. And we had about 75 people on Wayne State's campus. We had two people talking. One was a Sandy Hook relative and researcher. Another person was an NRA lobbyist. They talked for about 45 minutes. And unlike debates and unlike town forums and all of the nonsense that we've seen, and even watching our news programs with cry-ons going across, what we did is we broke people up into small groups. And we talked about, we had them talk about how they felt about what they heard. And it was teaching them to use what they've heard to see how that fits with their own values and belief systems. And what we found that first time, I had so many people shaking our hands saying, thank you so much for this. We did nothing. We did nothing. It was truly the magic that happens when people say, I want to know a little bit more. I want to know if how I feel is validated. Can you confirm that? Are you going to challenge me? Can I grow from this? And what people said, and this was for sure. And that we, and we've done this now for 5 years, and we've done this over school safety, gun control, immigration crisis, gerrymandering. What people say is a reminder about how we are so much more similar than we are different, and how important it is for us to be able to come together. So I do believe that conversations can change the world one person at a time. So that's one of my little I think we can change the world by one conversation at a time. That's been what I have found to be really, really effective. The second thing is when people that I'm with and are willing to go deeper than what is a box to check off for training. So I've got restorative practices training. I've got this training. When I am with people and we're exploring how to use restorative practices in social justice, how to use trauma-informed practices to move inequitable public policy. So what I'm hoping is that people are not satisfied with this shallow knowledge, that what it does is it actually entices them to go deeper because they understand that there's something even more. So I think that cultural proficiency training, restorative practices, all of these are kind of little pathways into this deeper spiritual work. I don't know how, I think it's kind of inevitable, but to get people in the turnstile, that's what I kind of feel like my role is here on earth, is that I'm trying to get people into the turnstile so that they can come and speak to people like you. Getting them out of the parking lot and into the venues.
Well, you know, it's interesting. I watched a Netflix documentary the other day. It was called Convergence. And I think that this is kind of what we're talking about. And what it did was show the already camouflaged disparities across the globe in terms of how people are treated, how they are seen in different classes, et cetera. And COVID exacerbated all of those things. And it kind of stripped away the emperor's clothes to say, you know, if someone is living in a situation that they didn't create, but they're a victim of it, why are we not doing something to bring equity here? And I think that that's what we have. I think that the biggest challenge that we are facing every day is that we all have to point the finger at ourselves. I am responsible. I am responsible for what I say. I am responsible for what I do. I am responsible for how I treat people. I am responsible to use the time that I have in this life to make a difference for the better. And if not, what am I doing and why? And I think no one is above that self-examination, the need to self-examine. And when we're able to do that, I would love to, as you know, we've talked so many times over the years, to work with you in this way. It is so, you know, we see, because we've seen trauma, we've experienced trauma, there's always a better way.
Always a better way.
Yes. And in, you know, again, going back to the medicine wheel, the significance of the wheel is that everyone is sitting in equal position around the circle.
Amen.
There is no party lines. There is no across the aisle. All of this is a human fabrication that does not truly exist except for in the barriers we create. And these have to come down.
They do. No, and when I'm teaching restorative practices and teaching little ones how to be in circle, and I share with them that the power of the circle is that it's not just that we all have an equal voice, but there really is no place to hide. But that's a good thing, because we all want to be seen and we all want to be acknowledged. It really does. It equalizes everything. It's true equity. And even a person that would keep a circle is only keeping the structure of it. It's only preserving that safety and sense of belonging in order for the community to be able to resolve or to celebrate or to do all of those things that the power of the circle allows you to do.
Well, that is why, you know, across the globe, historically, the circle has been such a very powerful symbol. And even in the language of mathematics, which most people don't realize that mathematics is an actual language that is distinctly different than arithmetic, and that the zero does not mean nothing. It means everything.
Yes.
Everything. There is no part that is separate from anything else. And when we understand that we bring our own sphere of influence, our aura is how we see our world. We need to learn how to clean up how we see our world. We need to clean the interior part of our thinking so that we can collaborate. We have no idea, truly, the amazing things that we are capable of until we step above and beyond the cesspool of behavior that we have allowed and normalized.
I think that that this idea about cleaning our own house, the recovery community has so much to teach us about these things, that people think that they are just going to convince people about how they should be feeling the way that I feel. You should feel how I feel. Instead of doing that introspective, instead of inspection, instead of doing that reflection, because there's a really good chance that you still have unexamined biases. You still have. I feel like I'm always surprised, and then not surprised at all, that I'll find myself, like, something will bubble up and I'll think, oh my goodness, that wasn't very evolved. That wasn't very enlightened. But that is the process of this. And what you had said before about how this, we're always changing in nature, in our lives, status quo is the beginning of death. Stagnation
Absolutely.
Is death. And then we have misunderstood what growth means. It's not larger or shinier and better. What does that truly mean? That means that we are trying every day to be the very best person that we can be in order to serve the world. But the way that we have redefined that over time, is in conflict with that. I feel like that the power of the circle internally is something that we that it really it substantiates that idea, because you can't have a winner. You can, but it's everybody that's winning. There can't be this imbalance that is constantly what we see.
There's a fascinating another medicine wheel called the circle of law. And it's interesting because in every medicine wheel, it follows what creation has done, what nature does. Everything begins in the east because every day begins with the sun rising in the east. But when any challenge is brought to the circle, the ones who are influenced the most by the outcome are the ones who bring the problem to the circle. So it is the young people who are called the contraries who come and sit directly across from the women. They sit directly across with those who are bringing life to say, are we willing to do a battle to potentially kill the life that you are holding right now? So immediately across the circle is the ones who are most directly and immediately affected by whatever decision is made in the circle. So the war chiefs always sit across from the peace chiefs. The healers always sit across from the warriors. It is always an understanding of balance. And I think that what we fundamentally need to do, again, is to, first of all, make this information known to people. And in the center of this medicine wheel, the circle of law, of which governance, true governance originated, but was unfortunately distorted and not used in its entirety, were the presiding chiefs. The presiding chiefs never enacted a law if it did not protect the lives of women and children. So a law that was not workable, or first of all, a law was always seen as an arrow, something that could move straight in a trajectory. But if for some reason they found that it was not workable, that arrow was broken in half. It literally meant this does not work. Let's come to another thought. Let's come to another conversation. Let's reconvene this circle. It was never fighting for the broken. It was, if this is broken, that means it doesn't work.
It's so interesting that you're saying that, because I see clearly that any of the policies that are being made now, it is truly an echo chamber. It is people in power that are only, they are their own audience, but never do they have, and if they do have people that are testifying in front of Congress, I saw this woman, I think that it was last week, and she was saying, I work two jobs, and she was that woman that she was facing a policymaker just like a contrarian would have spoken to the mothers, like what you were talking about in an indigenous circle. We have that opportunity, but there's it's like they come in not as a part of it, but just because it's a thing for them to do, but not really acknowledging those people that feel the impact of these policies and programs. We don't ever really take them into account. It is such a deficit mentality that we think that we're going to come in and we're going to do what's best for these people without thinking maybe we should ask them what they actually need.
Well, and I think, important to acknowledge, but I also think that it is important to recognize that we have so many layers of camouflage.
Oh, yes.
We have so many layers of, if we had really true transparency, if we understood that if someone is sitting in a position of authority, this is what they are given, this is what everyone should know, how much money they make, what kind of health care they're given, what kind of HR support that they're being given. And if they're coming and asking others to grovel for what they themselves would never give up. So I think part of the big challenge is we don't realize the agendas that others have. And so if we don't know what they're protecting, then we don't understand why they are not willing to see what is necessary to change. Because what might they lose? What might they have to give up? What might they have to admit to they've been willing to participate in?
Yes. Yes.
So honesty is so essential within a fire, within a circle, because there's a concept that can this be tempered by the fire? Will this hold up to the scrutiny of the fire? Meaning, is this going to just disintegrate, or is this going to be like steel being tempered with heat of a flame?
Right.
Is it going to be given strength by this flame, or is it going to just wither away? Some things need to wither away.
They do.
Yeah. So we're in this huge time of looking at, I think we have to look with compassion, Jem, I think. And tell me what you think about this. Everyone is wounded.
Oh, yeah.
Everyone. And we have to be willing to recognize everyone who is willing to fight or hold on to something that is not workable believes somehow that they are gaining. What are they actually gaining? And how do we help them to see the fallacy of that belief? Because time is ticking by, and every one of us will at some point be breathing our last breath. And will we honestly be able to say, I did a service to life, or I did a disservice to life? Either way, you are a part of life. Are you going to contribute? Or are you going to harm? And that is the bottom line of everything we're talking about here.
Yes. Yeah. This idea of service to community is absolutely essential. So in Indigenous culture, only responsibility teaches responsibility. That's actually W.E.B. Du Bois. So this is not, this is truly Indigenous culture worldwide. We do not teach responsibility in order to, we don't give responsibility in order to teach responsibility. Our idea of community service are clock hours. We don't really instill that idea that service to the community is our purpose here. And so how do we shift that mindset for those people who have completely defined success by materialism and individual achievement and competition and winner takes all, and we celebrate all of that? How do we move and make that shift? I think that the way that in is in the way that we are educating our children, and I'm not sure that public education can make that shift fast enough. This is one of those things where I vacillate. Is this system completely broken and it needs just to be dismantled and rebuilt so that it is something that's effective? Or can we tweak it? I don't know if we can.
Well, I think that if each one of us were to recognize that we're standing on one side of a very rapidly moving river, and in order to get to the other side, we have to cross a bridge. We need to understand, if we're looking at something that part of the bridge is missing, are you going to be foolish enough to attempt to go across that bridge? Or are you going to say, we need to tear this down and build something stable, lasting, meaningful, so that we can journey back and forth, so we can really understand what does it mean to be responsible? It does not mean you have a duty. It does not mean you have a task. It means, what is your ability to respond?
Yes.
What is your ability to comprehend what is happening? And how do you How do you contribute meaningfully? If you cannot, then your ability to respond does not exist and you need to step aside.
Yes.
And perhaps gain that wisdom. And when you do have that wisdom, then come forward. But until you have that ability, then you give it to someone who does.
Well, and I love this line of thinking, because we also don't say to people, hey, listen, you can't get with this program, you're out. Because that's the American way right now. We, in this new way of thinking, we say to people, we absolutely need you. You are an integral part of all of this. Hang out here. Trust us. In time, you will see. But that truly is the inclusive society that we need. That truly is the community. I've seen this in schools. Elaine, it's a beautiful thing where kids doing something down the hall, and I've heard a principal say, hey, listen, I care about you a lot, and we don't do that here. So mm-hmm. it's a totally different mentality. You're not going anywhere. It's like if you have that embarrassing relative at your Thanksgiving dinner that has a few glasses of wine and someone brings up politics and then the conversation goes down. You don't say to that person, okay, you're not our uncle anymore. We're not going to invite you to holiday. You find a way to restore the damage that's done. There, you learn about the damage that's done. You learn how to, reconstruct the day so that maybe there's not alcohol before dinner. But we don't kick people out. We don't kick people out because they are us. They are our community. And the idea that we would even think about excluding people without giving them an opportunity to be a part of us, that to me that's unconscionable.
You know, I had a great experience once with an elder who something happened and they became aware of it. And they brought everyone together that was at this gathering and stated clearly what happened and why it should not happen and what should happen in the future. So there was no opportunity for anyone at all to gossip.
Oh,
it was clear. It was clear. Well, Jem, our time has run out. How can people reach out to you?
JemMuldoon@gmail.com.
Okay, great. Well, yeah. We're out of time, so thank you very much. Happy winter solstice. Thank you for all that you do. We'll stay in touch, of course. This is Elaine Grohman on Earth Wisdom Circles on Empower Radio. Let's make our world a better place. It's up to you and me. Thank you.
Thank you, Elaine.
Thank you.